Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to begin our conversation with Francis Morlape, who is one of the great visionaries on our planet today. Has written numerous books that really get us thinking about who we are. She's co-founder of the Small Planet Institute. She's written, as I said, 18 books, including that bestseller, really that turned a lot of people around, Diet for a Small Planet. Her latest book is Getting a Grip 2, Clarity, Creativity, Courage for a World We Really Want. And welcome. It's good to have you back on the air with us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much.
It's been a long time. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, me too.
You all can join us here at 410-319-8888 for this conversation. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll get your thoughts on you that way. 410-319-8888. So this is a rewrite of an earlier book, which I forgot about that as I read it, because you kept talking about things that just happened last week.
Yeah, I hope that I will rewrite this book many times in my life, because this is really the distillation of my lifetime of asking why. Why are we creating this world that we as individuals would never, never create? We would, you know, really abhor in many ways. I mean, nobody gets up in the morning and says, yes, I want another child to die of hunger, and yet something like 25,000 are that day. So that this little book, Getting a Grip 2, I hope there will be a 3 and a 4 someday, but I think that's the question we got to ask, and we've got to probe that deep to get out of the hole we're in.
Take us for a little, just to pick up what you just said. I mean, I because you see things in a very interesting way. I mean, you see in this book in some ways that we're essentially an egalitarian species.
Isn't that surprising?
A lot of people would argue, of course we're not. And that it's that's a really interesting concept given the world we live in. You know, some people have said things like, you know, we're like just paleolithic beings whose bodies are stuck in this time warp in some ways.
They were what kind of beings?
The paleolithic beings stuck in this time warp. But I should talk a bit about that, this idea you have that we are essentially really egalitarian species and that...
It's really not my idea. This is the really interesting new developments in anthropology that seem to make a lot of sense when you think about it, that we evolved in small groups, and actually from what we can tell by looking at the anthropological record, but also hunter-gatherer societies that are living today, as we lived way back then, tens of thousands of years ago, that we basically, yes, when it was very egalitarian, that when there was food, everybody ate, and in fact, the most successful hunters were the ones who shared the most. And that we had what the anthropologists call counter-dominance strategies, which I kind of like that idea. We need that today. That we learned that if that one person got too big for his or her britches, that the whole tribe could be damaged by that, and that really what worked best was when everyone was cooperating and people felt that there were fair rules. And if people were, you know, constantly overthrowing the bully, that wasn't very stable. It wasn't very safe way to live out there when we were gatherers and hunters. So it kind of makes a lot of sense for me that now we're finding, I love the new neuroscience as well, that, you know, they look at our brains now and they can see what happens when we're cooperating and we're competing, for example. And they find that cooperating is our pleasure centers. It's the same place that gets excited when we eat chocolate, you know. So I love to think that cooperating is just as great as eating chocolate.
I want to get to this notion of mirror neurons, which we will do in a little bit, because I think that was a really interesting piece
of
the book.
Yeah, that's a very interesting piece of this new science, and that then speaks to our empathy, that we actually, when we want, well, you see it all the time. You'll see somebody stub their toe, and what happens? You flinch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why is that? Because they're actually, we are experiencing something of what we see. Some neurons in our brains are actually firing as if we just stubbed our toe. So think of the rich reservoir of sympathy and empathy that we have for each other. So, okay, Mark, if that's all true, then why?
I mean, why? I mean, when you write, you know, I was thinking about this one quote you have at the beginning of your book from Eric Fromm. It's man's humanity that makes him so inhuman. Well, he meant, I mean, we take beyond man, but but
that's a mind boggler, isn't it?
It is a mind boggler. But let me ask you this question about that in the context of what I mean, this the general perspective about who where we came from. I mean, we're also the species that created these complex societies we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see you struggling with in this book, and we'll get into a lot of specifics about living democracies versus the thin democracy that you argue that we have now, that Ben Barber has argued that we have as well, that in some ways, I mean, it seems like you're trying to figure out how to get ourselves back to where we were, but in the midst of this complex society, which is not going to be an easy trick.
No, but it may be the only trick that's going to work. It's maybe the only pathway. I mean, when we think of, do you realize that there are many more hungry people today, Mark, than there were when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet?
Yes, and that was amazing when I read that, yeah.
Do you know that one half of our children, think about this.
And that was 1970, right?
71.
71. 71, right, right.
But today, U.S. produces almost a quarter of the entire economic output of the world, and yet one half of our children will be living on food stamps at some point in their childhood. So that represents a pretty big hole, right? A pretty big problem.
It's a major contradiction.
Global climate change and, you know, just terrorism and epidemic disease, etc. But I'm just saying the theme of my book really is that the glorious thing about our minds is that we now can look back, we can reflect, we can look at history, we can look at these new lab experiments on us, and we can be pretty sure of what human nature really is. And if we can get a grip on that, and that's part of my title, get a grip on that, then actually the pathway is pretty clear, that we know what brings out the worst in us and we know what brings out the best in us. And in general terms, I mean, we could certainly, there are many, many ways to describe that, but I think in general terms, the historical and the lab record is pretty clear. So my thesis is that we live in this extraordinary moment when the you-know-what is hitting the fan, and we have what it takes. We have the consciousness, the knowledge that it takes to make this turn. The question is, do we have the courage? And so a lot of my book is really about what is courage and how do we cultivate courage in ourselves and our kids? Because I argue that actually we're good enough. We don't need to be, quote-unquote, better people. We need more backbone.
And I want to lead us up to there because that's where you conclude in this book and where you bring us to. But
you can pull us back.
Let me pull back to what if you talk a bit about, from your perception, your analysis, the several misleading ideas that prevail about our own nature as humans. You have a huge section early on in the book about these misleading ideas about what causes us to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So describe some of that for us. I mean,
I think, you know, we kind of slip and slide, all of us, in from day to day in a way of what we. But you see it. You see variants always. You know, variants of a couple main themes. One is that human beings, we've absorbed through our cultures, our religions, and you know, political messages that fundamentally that human beings are deeply flawed. And if you pull away all of the, you know, the extra stuff that we sort of put on, and you get down to our essence, that we're really, you know, Darwinian, supposed, you know, the false view of Darwin's idea that we're just, you know, tooth and claw, you know, trying to fight our way to the top, that we're basically self-centered, we're competitive, we're materialistic. You know, we are, you know, pretty tough characters. And I think so that's the one false idea. And from there, then, of course, the other false idea is, therefore, we can't really change anything until we transform human nature. And I think that's a pretty daunting, much more daunting than what I'm talking about, because I'm really not talking about changing human nature at all. I'm saying let's get a realistic grip on human nature. And in no way do I say that we are simply cooperative, empathetic, fairness-seeking, you know, can-do people. I'm saying that those qualities are hardwired in us for us to tap. But they're also, we know history also shows that not just a few of us, but most of us can behave downright cruelly, I mean brutal, evil, under the wrong circumstances. So the challenge is not just to appreciate these hardwired positive, what the sociologists, you know, and the anthropologists call our pro-social qualities, like empathy, but also to appreciate that we can't just point fingers at the bad guy, whether that's Osama bin Laden or, you know, George Bush or
Goldman
now,
Sachs.
You know, people yelling at President Obama, that we all have the capacity to be cruel. So the question is, what are the rules that we set together?
So
what do they bring out?
Now, there are a lot of folks, of course, who would argue that, that what you say is kind of really misleading about who we are, about this scramble we've made over scarce stuff, that's really what is in our makeup. And so you counter that. But I wonder if you see that as dismissing that completely, or is it really both a societal and human battle, an inner battle between human beings and within society over those tendencies that we have?
Well, I think, I acknowledge that all the things that we see now where people are willing to live in a world where needlessly over a billion people go hungry, it's pretty hard not to call that callous. I mean, I think that we are capable. Look at the Holocaust. I mean, that wasn't just a few madmen or one crazy guy at the top. I mean, there were ordinary people I describe in the book, you know, the ordinary
right.
people who participated. So, I mean, it's we know it's there. The question is, do we step up and say, okay, let's create the rules and the norms together, from how we teach our kids to how we set the rules on Wall Street, so that banks aren't too big to fail, so that things aren't completely opaque, that we can actually see what's going on. You know, that we know. I argue in the book, because it seems like you've read it, you know too what I say there, that that there are really three conditions that I've picked out, and I'm sure we could debate what are the key ones, but I've picked out three conditions that wherever they appear, we come to no good. In other words, the concentration of power tends to bring out the worst in us, whether we're talking about a bully on the playground or, you know, corporate concentration on Wall Street and what it brought to the world, the suffering and the hunger. So concentrated power is one. The other is anonymity, in other words, secrecy, not knowing that we can get away with something because nobody's watching. And I talk about the Wall Street people who did the fancy-dancy products that they knew were, you know, really risky. They knew the housing market was shaky, but they knew they could clean up first. And their slogan was, I'll be gone, you'll be gone, IBG, YBG. So the point is that when we know that we are anonymous, we can often think we can just slip by. And then the third, we see it so big right now, is scapegoating, just pointing fingers at one another rather than saying, how am I responsible for solutions too?
So let's take that for a moment. I mean, one of the things you do, though, say is that, and you kind of inkling to in the beginning of your book to what you're going to talk about later in many different, in kind of different forms, which is the idea that and you just kind of talked about it for a second a minute ago, which is the idea that the problem is that when we have top-down structures, and one of the things I found really interesting was a comparison you made in the book. You said that the left in America sees huge corporations from the top down, mass corporations controlling the world, controlling our lives, is a really very dangerous thing. Then you wrote that, and the right wing sees large central government that dictates things from the top as very dangerous to our democracy and our well-being. And you kind of said, look, these things really, are they that different? That we're looking at mirror images of the same argument.
Right. So why don't we get together instead of yelling at each other?
So talk about why they're mirror images and how do you think we could get together?
Well, I think the instinct is good. Absolutely. I think that concentrated, unaccountable power brings out the worst in human beings. And this is, you know, I'm repeating myself, but, you know, we see that in the most mundane ways, in horrible ways, you know, with bullies, on up to the top of corporate power today. Say, McDonald's, who's feeding food to kids that they certainly know is bringing on the 1 in 3 children who's going to be diabetic in their lifetime. So that degree of concentrated power, you lose touch and you just think you can get away because you have the power. And we see it over and over. So I think that both the right and the left are onto something. The question is that You know, they have to work together. In other words, I recently posted an essay on Huffington Post where the title was, "What's Government Good For Anyway?" Mm-hmm. And I pointed out that the issue is not big or small, which is what the conservative focuses on, that somehow small is automatically better. But I point out that in India, and in the book I point this out, that in India during colonial period in which the Indians were suffering, there was one British civil servant for every 300,000 Indians, and they managed to keep them in a subservient position and benefit the crown, benefit people far away. So small is not necessarily freeing. The question is accountability. The question is, are we watching, or are there transparent mechanisms so that our bodies of power, whether they be corporate or government, are really answering to us, and we can change them if they're not, and we have representatives looking out for our interests? And so that's why, actually, my son, who's a filmmaker, made a little video. Have you seen the video, the Real Boston Tea Party video?
I have not seen it. I've heard about it, but I have not seen it yet.
Okay. Well, it's 2 minutes, and it makes the point. I'm trying to reach out to Tea Party people, and it shows these images of the Tea Partiers in 1774 throwing all this tea into the bay, you know, into Boston Harbor. And actually, you know what, Mark? That was as much a protest against a multinational corporation, the East India Company, as it was against the government.
Right.
And so I'm trying subtly, you know, through a kind of humorous way, because it's kind of funny, a funny little two-minute video, but to reach out, and I mentioned the Tea Party and the Coffee Party after that, but to remind us that it's the collusion today, where we have last year $3.5 billion spent by lobbyists, most of them working for corporations, you know, influencing our legislators who are supposed to be answering to us. There are more than two dozen lobbyists for each person that we've elected. So that's a problem, and that's concentrated power. That is the collusion of the two, private. I call it privately held government.
We're joined today by Frances Moore Lappe. Her latest book, Getting a Grip to Clarity, Creativity, Courage in the World We Really Want. Of course, she's also the author of Diet for a Small Planet, Hope's Edge. Join us here at 410-319-8888. You can challenge some of the ideas we're talking about. Talk about your own ideas, what it means to have a living democracy, which is what we're about to talk about now, and how you think we can or cannot control or take control of the world we inhabit. It's like the exercise we did yesterday in the show when we had regular citizens on here and not the leaders talking about what to do about the budget crisis in Baltimore City and how we can come up with better and stronger ideas than some of those who we've elected to office. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Frances Moore Lappe. So one of the things you talk about here, and I really want to get down to the meat of this. This is when you talk about we're living in a thin democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben Barber's been a guest on the show a number of times as well. So he's
wonderful. Yes, I credit him with that term. He has been a mentor to me. His book, Strong Democracy, had a real impact on me.
An amazing book. We went to the same high school, so I claim that. So there's a claim to fame.
Yes.
So let's talk about this idea of thin democracy, and then ease us into the notion of what a living democracy means. But what is you write that a thin democracy is a danger to democracy and a danger to what our conceptions are about a democracy.
Right, because it is based on this very false notion of human nature itself, so it cannot work. And I describe thin democracy as what I grew up with, thinking that, oh, aren't I lucky? I live in this democracy. There's nothing much for me to do because democracy is just elections plus a market economy. And wait a minute. Then I grew up and I traveled the world and I saw quite a few countries in which there were elections and a market economy and people were living in misery. You know, India, supposedly this great democracy, has more people going hungry than in all of sub-Saharan Africa. So I had to rethink that democracy is not just a simple duo, that it is a living practice. If it's going to work, it's a living practice. It is a set of values that fit and permeate every dimension of life. It's not just about politics. And I just want to make clear to anyone who's been listening all the way through so far that my work is really not about theory, like, oh, this is what I would like. But it's really describing what I see emerging, but it's just invisible to the wider culture for the most part. So I just want to make clear that as I'm describing thin democracy as what I grew up with, there is something else that I believe can be the next historical stage, because what happens with thin democracy, we have, based on this very dim view of human nature, we turn over our fate to a marketplace that is a very peculiar variant of a market, and that is what we've accepted in this country is a market driven by one rule, and that rule is highest return to people who already own the wealth. And so now we end up with wealth accruing to wealth accruing to wealth until 1% of us control as much wealth as the bottom 90% of households. That is anathema to democracy, because that translates also into political power as well as economic power. So thin democracy is our undoing. And in fact, I think it's a bit, not to in any way criticize my mentor, Ben Barber, but I think it's a little charitable at this point. Maybe we need a stronger term, like publicly held government. I mean, excuse me, publicly held government, right.
I mean, so, the way you describe it, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Had you finished that thought?
Well, I just wanted to just close that thought with this, that it dawned on me in writing this that, you know, we tend to think of the market and democracy as brother and sister, and yet they are based on very different principles. They can only be brother and sister, sort of partners, under certain conditions. Because if you think about this market I'm describing, where wealth accrues to wealth accrues to wealth, we do end up with one family, the Waltons of Walmart, controlling as much wealth, almost as much as 40% of the population, half our kids, depending on food stamps at some point. And so we end up with concentrated power. But democracy, so that's the market. Democracy is supposed to be about dispersion of power so that we each have a voice. We each have say. And so in a sense, they're kind of organized on opposite principles. So the only way they work together is if the one person, one voice part, the democracy part, creates a truly accountable market, one that answers to us so that their values, boundaries, I think, for example, antitrust, anti-monopoly, that the market by itself is not free because it ends up in monopoly. And so we have to create a real accountable living democracy to make the market free.
What's described as a thin democracy, though, is also a very powerful political machine and corporate power that kind of really dictates a lot about what we think and how we feel. And you're right about that. I mean, it can dominate. It's its own mirror neurons. It dominates what we think, and we see ourselves in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's hard, and people feel often that this power is so immense that there's very little you can do about it at this point, because they're so deeply rooted in making all the decisions. And despite what, look at the health care bill. It was probably better than anything America's ever done. But clearly, even though 56% of the American people or more wanted to see a single-payer option, people did not get out in the streets about it. And they said, we can't control this. And they didn't get it. And we didn't get it, I should say.
Right.
You know, I mean, so this is, I mean, isn't part of the dilemma is, I mean, this huge power is very difficult for people to think about how they can overcome it, change it, or live in a different way.
Right. But I believe that that power is the power of an idea primarily. It is held together by our belief in our own powerlessness and our belief that somehow that is justified and that's just the natural workings of the economy, that kind of concentration, and there's nothing we can do. It's almost like a natural force of nature. Well, I just so strongly disagree that power, I have, as you know, a whole section on power. What is power? Power is just our capacity to act. And people, even the biggest corporations, have been made to change, and the rules have been made to change. I mean, we're not talking about monolith here. We're not talking about power being some fixed thing. Power is created moment to moment by the ideas and actions that we're each taking. For example, when I was in my 20s and 30s in the 60s, that power, our power, citizens stepping up to the plate, we actually cut the poverty rate in half in one decade in the 1960s. But that success has been taken from us because many people remember Ronald Reagan saying, oh, yes, we had a war on poverty, and poverty won. Well, we've been robbed then of belief in ourselves, and therefore to believe in the power of active citizens in a living democracy, the only way to do that is to actually meet people who are themselves, don't buy into that, and build off that energy, build on that courage, because moment to moment, I have so many stories in the book.
You do.
Of people who said, oh, wait a minute, things are just really bad, and I'm not going to walk away. I'm going to create something. And one of my favorite stories in the book is about just a handful of kind of ragtag farmers I met in western Wisconsin in 1988. And their friends were going out of business. Some were committing suicide. It was a desperate time in the 80s for farmers. So they decided to create an organic cooperative, one person, one vote, to market their organic dairy. And I thought, how nice, you know? I was very maternalistic. How nice. And little did I ever suspect that today that company is a half-billion-dollar company with 1,400 or 1,500 farmers all across the country, and I buy their stuff in Boston. So, you know, power is not fixed. It's what we create.
We're talking with Frances Morlape. We have to get a very brief break. And when we come back, we talk more about her book, Getting a Grip 2. We're going to explore some of these stories that she has in her book about how you create a living democracy, how we actually gain power for ourselves and for our children and for our future, how we think power. And she does it through stories of many people's struggles in this country and what they're trying to create. I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. And why she argues that this is not about anti-capitalism necessarily, but anti-plutonomy. We'll talk about that and more when we return. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to mecu.com for more information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Frances Morlape is our guest for this hour. Of course, she wrote Diet for a Small Planet. We're talking about her latest work out, Getting a Grip 2, based on her other book, Getting a Grip. Clarity, creativity, courage for the world we really want. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. As we go into this, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Now back to our conversation with Frances Morlape. So just picking where we left off, because I think that it's important here. You write, when you start talking about a living democracy, you use a lot of people's examples from Lizzie Maggie, did I get her name right?
Yeah.
From the past.
Yeah.
And the creation of Monopoly, which I thought was a really interesting kind of piece, is kind of emblematic of all your thoughts. But then you write about a lot of people like Martha McCoy and many others who are living and breathing this stuff. Let's wander through some of these people. First of all, you got to tell our listeners the story of Lizzie Maggie.
Well, Monopoly was not actually invented by Parker Brothers, but by a Quaker woman in the early 1900s who figured out that if she could create a kind of board game, I think it was kind of drawn on tablecloths at that point, but that would teach people the fundamental problem of our economy if we didn't set rules that prevented it, and that is that all the property would move into one person's hands. And as I say in the book, in my house, it was always my brother at the end of the night, and I couldn't even afford Baltic Avenue. Well, it was okay in a game because I wanted to go to bed, but it's not okay in life, right, when one person controls it all and the rest of us are out on the street. So Maggie was hoping that this would waken people to the need for creating a democratic economy that would really use the market to keep it free, you know, to keep it free and fair, to keep it able that we could all participate in it. But I guess we didn't pay any attention, and it did get into the hands of Parker Brothers and sort of proved her point, because I think there are now like three companies who control most of board games in America. So it was an ironic twist, but I was delighted to honor her insight way back then, and if we'd only listened to her.
You know, what you just said about who owns toys and toy manufacturing,
right.
And you've said that in the book about a lot of things. Who controls the media? Who controls toys? Who controls almost anything you can think about?
Right.
Is in the hands of a narrow, small group of people and corporations.
Right. Yep.
That's that.
And it's happened to the degree that it has. Certainly, there have been times, you know, in our history when power was extremely concentrated, but this period is happened in, you know, it's really intensified just in the last 30 years. Just one emblematic example for me, focused on food, is the Monsanto Corporation. How many Americans know that this one company controls the germplasm in seeds that are all, you know, 80 to 90, over 90% of all the corn and soy planted in the United States, controlled basically by one company? Now, the consequence of that is that since 2001, the price of those seeds for farmers has gone up at 4 to over 6 times the rate of the consumer price index. That's what monopoly does. That's why it's not a fair and free market. So that I think that the wacky idea that I want to dislodge from our consciousness that will move us in the direction of living economy is simply the idea that a middle-class society evolves automatically, or that the market just works on its own. That was the false idea that was implanted in us so strongly from the 1980s onward, with the language of Ronald Reagan talking about the magic of the market, as if it were magic, that we could just let it do its thing and we'd all be okay. And here we are with, now, you mentioned plutonomy. I hadn't used that word, but I got that not from Citibank, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their term for an economy driven by the very wealthy, and that's where they say we are. That there is only now the very rich and the rest of us make up a pretty small slice of the economic pie.
I mean, it was interesting when you wrote that in your book that came out of a document they wrote kind of congratulating themselves that this is the world we're in.
Well, they wrote that as an advisory for their clients, so that basically they kind of say, yeah, invest in toys for the rich, because that's where we're headed. And that was before the meltdown. And now we know that, of course, the international financial meltdown has greatly increased the number of billionaires in many countries. I think in India it doubled the number of billionaires while the world was suffering and more Indians were going hungry, because a meltdown just will accelerate the most vulnerable people or the most hurt. And people who can clean up the mess, you know, in other words, take advantage of the mess, in other words, go out and buy, as people are doing today, speculators buying property really, really cheap. And then as the economy comes back, they're in great shape, right? So they had some wealth to invest in that way, and so the downfall really helped them.
Well, I want to talk about some of the parts of the book that I think that in some ways are maybe some of the most important, and I think just because of what the examples that they give, and they when you start talking about what democracy really feels like and about how you create new power. I mean, because a lot of things we outline on this program that we've outlined a little bit in this conversation that we've been having together now are the things that make people go, oh, my God. This is just,
right.
I can't handle this, and I don't want to hear any more of this stuff. I want to just, let me go have a glass of wine or go pick up my kids and play soccer. I can't deal with this.
Right.
So
that's not what my book is about.
No, it's not.
It's the good stuff, right?
let's talk about this whole idea of and the examples you give about what democracy feels like, though, because you hone in on human beings who are taking it on for themselves and their communities and actually changing things. And you see that as more powerful than almost in some ways a direct hit up against the power within democracy itself.
Absolutely. And there are many, many, many. Where do I start? I think that one of the things that I came back to in this edition, because I found it so interesting, that even the terminology, a community benefit agreement, is a brand new sort of way of thinking about community development, and maybe it's happening in Baltimore. That's where you are, right?
Yes.
Yes. And but it's the idea that community groups can gain the power, that is by their determination, ingenuity, persistence, to actually make deals with large developers to ensure that anything that happens in their community benefits the local people. And so I started with this whole idea of a community benefit agreement. This is not a mushy sort of, oh, would you please? This is a legally binding agreement. And one of the first in the nation was about the expansion of LAX, the big airport in Los Angeles. And a whole group of citizen organizations got together and said, don't you even think about this expansion unless you are going to be improving our communities in the process, training and hiring us to do this. And they won enormous commitments that are legally binding. And now this example, this is the, you know, courage is contagious, the mirror neurons you see and you do, that now many other communities are taking this approach. So this is not getting away from the market in the sense, but it's making the market work for us. It's introducing values into the market. And so I love this example. And another is another thing I talk about in various points in the book. It's probably well exemplified in the ad I heard, MeQ.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, that's a credit union. That is very much in the spirit of we don't have to just put our money in large, unaccountable banks that then charge us right and left for overdraft and all the other ways that happened that we've been so unaware of how much we're losing that way. And so I tell about democratic cooperatives and how, one of my favorite examples of democratic business organization is people in New York City, people who are coming off welfare and starting their own home health care agency that is now setting an industry standard for quality of care and quality of job, home health care associates. And people have gone from feeling quite powerless as welfare recipients to sitting on the board and developing this organization and creating a training institute to show others how this can be done, because home health care is such a vital part of every, you know, so many families' lives, of need for people to come in and help with infirmed people. So I think that it's shocking when I one of the statistics in the book that I think most makes people blink is when I say that there are probably as many people who are members of democratic cooperatives in the world than who are owning shares in publicly traded companies.
That's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, and in India. Okay, what's your image of India? Oh, a lot of high-tech boom, and you get these nice young people on the phone when you have a technical problem. Well, actually, women in their villages doing dairy cooperatives have created maybe 6 times more jobs than the high-tech industry. So we need to feel that you don't, as I argue in this book, that power is not just in money, official status, guns. It is in our ingenuity, our knowledge, our humor. And I tell stories about how humor has been used to rock the boat and hopefully will continue. And you know, also I tell stories in terms of law enforcement, for example, that I'm not sure if you have in Baltimore, but many, many communities are involving the community itself in helping to deal with nonviolent offenders instead of just locking them up. They are actually using committees of citizens in the neighborhood to ensure that there is restitution made, that the person who, for example, snatched a purse has to go face that person who they snatched it from and then make restitution to that person, so there's real healing going on. This is happening in really thousands of places across the world, this approach to law enforcement. That's, again, the theme here is that we don't just point the finger and of blame, but we step up to be part of the solution ourselves and trust our ingenuity and our courage.
And I think those lessons that are learned from that, we do have that kind of thing in Baltimore growing a little bit. Lauren Abramson, who has a community mediation project, is that based on the whole Maori principle of that kind of mediation, is doing that. And I think those kinds of things are the things that can transform, but they do have to kind of go from the bottom and bubble up in small groups and then create kind of their own wave.
Right. And at the end of the book, I talk about three course changers, three kind of the big waves that, and one of them is very much this letting go of the notion in communities that we are at each other's throats and pointing fingers and really building community bonds and valuing our young people and bringing them into this kind of community mediation work at the community level. And the two other course changers have to do with getting real about getting money out of our system. And the good news is that the best-kept secret in America, I think, is that we do know how to do that, and it's happening in three states. And it is a bill in Congress now called Fair Elections Now, Fair Elections Now Act, that would allow a really great system of public financing so that you could, and I tell the story of one of my heroes, Deb Simpson in Maine, who ran using public financing because she was a waitress, a single mom and a waitress in the year 2000. But because of public financing, she was able to run using, once she proved herself that she could get a certain number of very small donations, $5 from 50 people. That was it for her. And she proved that she was viable. And she was a waitress and thought, well, I can do this. And she's remarkable. She's gone on to sit on the Judiciary Committee of the state, and she's helped pass legislation that has kept a pound of lead per person out of the ecosystem of beautiful Maine. And she would never have had a chance if we hadn't stepped up, we citizens, and gotten money out. And so that's the second course changer. And then the third course changer is what we've been talking more about, which is creating a democratic bounds around the market, creating fair rules to keep the market fair and open and free. And all these, I think, there's not a chicken and the egg. You know, they all are happening at once, but still need more of us to see them and want to lend our ingenuity and our voices to them.
We're talking to Frances Moore Lappe. Her book, Getting a Grip to Clarity, Creativity, Courage for the World We Really Want, an inspiring book about what we can do to grab hold of our democracy, make it work, create our own living democracy, to build a future that we want and we want for our children. 410-319-8888. Write us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. And Thomas in Churchville, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Moore, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, thanks for calling.
My question to your guest, other than the project that you spoke about with LAX and developers coming in, what other areas that the developers are actually partnering with the community? Because in Baltimore, we have a lot of buildings and stuff going on, but they're not partnering with the community.
Well, that's the problem. And that, I would really encourage you to talk directly to the people in Los Angeles who I interviewed at this organization called LANNE, Los Angeles. But on our website, gettingagrip.org, there are links to this organization. It's LANNE, I believe, .org.
Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. Is that the one?
Thank you. Right. Los Angeles right. Alliance for a New Economy. And really call them and talk to them, because they got together this very diverse group that included unions and church groups and others, and they trained each other, in effect, how to present, how to negotiate, to talk through what are the real most important things and which should you compromise on and which would you never compromise on. And so it was a very thorough process of building their power over some time. And I know from talking to those folks that they have probably a lot of material and written about how they did what they did. And I think that's exactly the kind of sharing, so that we don't feel like we're inventing the wheel. And when I talked to Madeline Janis, is the executive director I interviewed, she gave me any number of places that this is happening across the country. So I bet if you went on their website and looked for a community benefit agreement and talked to them directly, they could give you a lot of advice. Or not exactly advice, but just tell you what they did and see if any of it could apply.
Thomas, I'm glad you're listening. Thanks so much. Come back to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And I think that there are a couple of things you said in here before we run out of time I really want to get to. And I love some of the notions, right? When you talk about how to create the conflict, can be creative, that you can get to move things along if you do it in a certain way. And one of the keys to it, is listening, which I think is such a powerful statement. People ask, what's communication? The one thing people don't say is listening.
Right. Yeah, we're trained to think, organizing means going out and selling people on our great idea, like
right.
a community benefit agreement. But what I learned is I've really tried to observe effective community organizing, that often if people are deeply listened to, that they come up with solutions. One of my favorite stories in the book is about the Listening Project in North Carolina, where they go door to door, often working with low-income communities, and they just begin listening, and not just in a check-off, not just a simple questionnaire, but deep listening. And they talk about interviewing this middle-aged white guy who, when they started with him, he was just pointing fingers at all
yes.
the young black people in the
right.
neighborhood who were making too much noise and prone to violence or whatever he was saying about them. But the end of it, he realized he was listening to himself and realized that the solution to the problem is that these kids, you know, needed jobs, they needed recreational opportunities, and that's what the answer was, not just pointing fingers. So listening is very powerful, and part of that then, of course, is recognizing that conflict is not failure, that conflict can be a proof of success, that you're really bringing diverse voices together. And so I talk about the art of conflict surfacing. It's not just the art of conflict resolution. It's really recognizing that maybe we need more conflict in our society if half of our children are, you know, having to live on food stamps at some point, but not the kind of point finger, scream and call names and spit at each other, but conflict that says, this is not working for me, and here's what I think of the answer is, and here's what I need for you to think about, and here's what I want to help to legislate anew and get a new system going for electing our public officials. So I think that these I call the arts of democracy, and talk about that just like we learn to ride a bicycle, that we have to learn how to do democracy. And actually there's a downloadable handbook on our website called Doing Democracy, precisely, you know, about these 10 arts I talk about in the book.
And you also talk about the need that, and you talk about your own personal sojourn with this, which is to find courage, and that we can find both courage as we rethink power.
Well, I spend a lot of time talking about fear in the book, because I think that what stops us a lot is that we recognize that breaking with our social group, this was hardwired in us over our wonderful long time, as you pointed out, you know, as in the book it says egalitarian, you know, that we were really cooperating with one another, but it also means that we have hardwired in us a real fear of separation, fear of being different from
mm-hmm.
our peer group. And if we're going to change the world to create the world we want, we better be able to step aside and say, no, this is not working. And so fear is going to be with us. It's going to be part of our lives. And I think we have to my claim is, at least in my life, I'm trying to do this, to think when I get afraid, to think, oh, that's interesting. That's information. That's energy. That pounding heart, that is just energy. That maybe it's telling me I am right where I should be. I'm just pushing that edge. And so all of these, the terms we use about getting over fear and avoiding it and avoiding our discomfort, that I think we have to totally rethink and encourage each other to do what scares us. And you know, I talk in the book about a moment when, you know, the kind of moment where I wish I had had that, what I call civil courage.
Right.
In a scene in the 2004 elections where my candidate was, you know, she was accused of being somehow connected to the Taliban.
Yes, I read that. Was so
robocalls. And she stood up in the debate where we in the audience were supposed to be silent, and her opponent would not disown this totally dishonest ad. And what now, Mark, I wish I had done, and this is what I mean by courage, if I had not yelled but just stood and quietly said, I will remain standing until Jim Gerlach disowns this ad, I will remain standing not just for my candidate, but for democracy. Democracy. How do we gain our courage to stand up for it, for this deepest value of each of us having a voice? And that's what I mean, and that's what I want to gain strength, and I want to find people, and I am finding them, you know, who are taking those risks. And so I have a little cheesy gimmick that I describe in the book. When I get the pounding heart, that's when I get scared. So I've renamed that pounding heart inner applause. And it kind of works.
That's good. You have to find something to make yourself stand up sometimes.
Right. It's better than saying, oh, you wimp, you know, why are you so nervous? That doesn't help.
No, right. It just makes it worse.
Right.
And one of the things you close with here, now, folks, you're calling in now. I wish you called in earlier so we could get your calls in here. But we'll try to have Frances Morlape back on sometime in the next couple months to continue this conversation with all of you. Maybe get her down here to Baltimore if that's possible. You close by saying that this is our moment to do or die. This is our moment. We have to really go after it now, as a species, as human beings.
Exactly. This is it. I mean, if you look even at the most conservative numbers in terms of the direction of where we're headed with global climate change and with poverty spreading, and poverty here at home spreading, we've got to find that backbone, and so we've got to recognize, I do at the very end talk about the marriage, or the, I don't know if I've used that term, but that justice and democracy have to join hands now, and we have to go beyond just fighting the negative injustice, and we have to pull out the best in us, that courage and that joy of cooperation, and that's the spark. And I think now that, you know, we see the ugliness with some of the people in the Tea Party, how do we find the courage to reach out to them? And one of the things I love about the Coffee Party is they're saying, hey, you know, we have to sign a civility pledge and trust that we can talk to one another, and they're bringing people together that way, and they're trying to reach out to Coffee Party people. That's the kind of courage that we need right now. And anybody who's not been able to get on and talk about this and would like to weigh in, and I will definitely read what you say, we have a form on our website, gettingagrip.org, where people are weighing in on these core ideas about living democracy and plutonomy and where we're headed and what we can do, what is power. And so I would love to hear from anyone, and I'd love to come back, Mark. I'm going to be in D.C. in May, so maybe I could come back then.
That'd be great. We'd love to have you. Thank you so much for joining us for a whole hour and for the book you've just written, Getting Grip, Frances Morlape. It's been great to have you on the air with us.
Great pleasure for me, Mark. Thank you for all you do.
Take care. So we'll be back in just a moment, and we have all that stuff on our website, steinershow.org, so you can connect to all of Frances Morlape sites, and we'll try to get her back on soon and create a real strong community conversation about what we can do to control our own community and create our own living democracy right here in Baltimore, Washington, and Maryland. We're going to take a short break. I'm going to come back right now and see if you know what's a Higgs boson. And what do you mean that they've made something go at the speed of light, that crashed into one another under the earth in France and Switzerland, that may help discover how the universe began? All that and more when we come back from this break. So stay with us.